Imagine you are sitting in the fourth row of a crowded theater.
Okay.
The lights are blindingly bright. The air is, a little too warm. And suddenly, the performer on stage points directly at you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The instant panic.
Right. Your heart does that little flutter, that immediate spike of adrenaline. You pull up the stairs. The floorboards are creaking under your feet. And hundreds of eyes are locked onto your every move.
It is a lot of pressure.
It really is. In that exact moment, how reliable do you think your memory is?
Oh.
I mean, how much of your own free will do you actually possess when the environment around you has been meticulously engineered by a master manipulator?
Well, if we're being honest with ourselves, almost none. Like, zero. The illusion of free will is incredibly fragile, especially when you step into an environment controlled by someone who actually understands the blind spots of the human brain.
And that's usually where my mind goes to something like a bank heist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when we think of deception or theft, we expect brute force.
Yeah, you expect a tangible breach.
Exactly. It's an engineering problem. You blow the vault door off its hinges, the alarms are screaming, the sprinklers are going off, and the detective just points at this shattered smoking metal and says, well, there's the breach.
Right, because that's binary. The perimeter is either secure or it has been visibly broken. The cause and the effect are just incredibly clean.
It is clean, and honestly, it is comforting in a weird way.
It is.
We like deception to be visible. We like to trace it back to a single broken lock.
Mm-hmm.
But today, we are exploring a landscape of deception that is completely invisible.
The invisible heist.
Yeah. The vault is utterly empty. Not a single alarm was tripped. And the security guards are swearing under oath that they handed the money over willingly.
It is the absolute definition of a cognitive blind spot.
Welcome to the deep dive.
All right.
Today, our mission is to pull back the curtain on a very specific, highly sophisticated mentalism routine called B.O.B.
Created by the renowned performer Luc Germain.
Right. But we aren't just going to look at the trick itself. Our goal today is to really deconstruct the exact architecture of an illusion. We're going to break down the highly guarded methods of forcing choices and gaining secret information at every single step of this routine.
And our roadmap for this exploration is just brilliant. It's an original 2008 manuscript penned by Germain himself.
It's a gold mine.
It really is. It is a rare, incredibly detailed masterclass in psychological manipulation, time misdirection, and, mechanical deception. It is the kind of document that usually stays locked away in the proverbial vault of working professionals.
So by the end of this deep dive, you're going to understand exactly how a performer can seemingly predict a completely random string of events. But more importantly, you're going to understand why your own brain, well, the human brain in general, is so easily fooled when different methods of deception are layered on top of one another.
It's a fascinating look at our own vulnerabilities.
So let's unpack this. The manuscript describes this routine as a confabulation. For those of us who aren't currently sitting in a velvet-lined magic club, what exactly is a confabulation routine?
Well, a confabulation routine is essentially a neoclassic in the world of mentalism.
Okay.
At its core, it is an effect where a multi-layered prediction, usually written down on a piece of paper or a letter, is shown to perfectly match a series of seemingly entirely free choices made by the audience.
So it's not just a single guess.
Exactly. It's not just guessing one single thing, like a playing card. It is predicting a cohesive narrative. A location, a name, a time, an object, a physical description.
And the reveal is usually pretty dramatic, right?
Oh, absolutely. Often the performer will reveal this prediction locked inside a wallet or zipped in a pouch or even inside an inflated balloon, proving that it couldn't possibly have been tampered with during the routine.
It's just a cascade of impossibilities. But in the introduction of this manuscript, Germain essentially asks, well, why fix something that isn't broken?
Right, because it's a very popular routine.
He notes that this classic routine is used by working pros all over the world. People get massive standing ovation reactions with it. So if it works so well, what was his actual problem with the classic method?
Yeah.
Why did he feel the need to tear it down and rewrite the blueprint?
What's really fascinating here is that Germain recognized a profound stagnation in the methodology.
How so?
Well, performers were spending all their time updating the presentation. They were writing better jokes. They were finding more compelling storytelling hooks. They were buying fancier leather wallets.
Right, upgrading the packaging.
Exactly. But the underlying secret mechanics hadn't evolved in decades. The classic method relies almost entirely on something called double writing.
Okay, what does that mean in practice? What is double writing?
Double writing is exactly what it sounds like. It's where the performer secretly writes down the audience's choices on the hidden prediction paper during the performance, right under their noses, while pretending to do something else.
Which sounds incredibly risky.
If
I'm watching you and you're secretly scribbling something, human beings are pretty good at detecting suspicious movement.
We are. From an evolutionary standpoint, our brains are hardwired to notice incongruous movements.
Right, like if the rustling in the bushes doesn't match the wind.
Exactly. If someone's hands are moving in a way that doesn't match their words, our internal alarm bells just ring. But it's not just the visual risk. It causes a massive structural problem with the pacing of the show.
The pacing?
Yeah, because if you have to secretly write down four or five different pieces of information while an audience of hundreds is burning a hole into you with their eyes, there is an inevitable time delay.
Oh, right. You have to stall.
You absolutely have to stall. You ask the spectator for a location, they say Paris, and then you have to stand there making awkward small talk while your thumb is secretly furiously scribbling P-A-R-I-S inside your jacket or under a clipboard.
That sounds agonizing.
It is. The performer has to find logical cover for standing there. Jermay looked at this and basically said, "This is a flaw. The engine is inefficient. I need to overhaul it."
So what exactly was he trying to achieve with this new version? If he's throwing out the old engine, what does the new one actually look like?
He had four very specific goals for BOB.
Okay, lay them out.
First, he wanted to absolutely minimize the time spent double writing.
Makes sense.
Second, he wanted to maximize the amount of predicted information to make the reveal even more overwhelming. Third, and this is the big one, he wanted to create a profound logical disconnect in the minds of the audience.
A logical disconnect.
Yes. And fourth, any time delay that did exist had to have bulletproof logical cover.
I want to zoom in on that third point, this idea of a logical disconnect. I really feel like that is the crux of this entire deep dive. What does a logical disconnect actually mean when we're talking about fooling the human brain?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of human cognition, a logical disconnect is the ultimate weapon in deception. Think about how a normal, highly intelligent person watches a magic trick.
They try to figure it out immediately.
Right. Their brain immediately tries to reverse engineer it. They are looking for the single point of failure. We evolve to find linear causality. If the rustling in the bushes means a tiger is there, there is a one-to-one relationship between cause and effect.
So if a trick uses one single method, the brain can just track it back to the source.
Precisely. If the entire confabulation trick relies on just one method, say, secretly double writing everything with a hidden pen, an astute audience member only needs to spot one weird thumb movement.
Or notice one awkward delay.
Exactly. And suddenly the whole house of cards collapses. Their brain connects the cause to the effect. They think, ah, he was stalling because he was writing.
And once they figure out one piece, they apply that theory to the rest of the trick. And the mystery is just dead.
Because they found the single trapdoor.
Yes. But Jermay's genius is that he combines multiple, entirely different, contradictory methods of deception into one single routine.
It's brilliant layering.
He uses psychological forces, mechanical forces, planted predictions, stage whispers, and double writing, all layered together seamlessly. Because the methods keep changing, the audience cannot trace a single line of logic back to the beginning.
It's like trying to untangle a knot where every thread is made of a different material, and some of them are just invisible.
That is exactly what it is. If an engineer in the audience suspects a trick watch, that theory doesn't explain how the performer knew a thought of color.
Right.
If a psychologist in the audience spots a behavioral force, that doesn't explain their predicted birthday. The brain gives up trying to find a unified theory of the trick, because the data is too conflicting.
It's simply short circuits.
Yeah. It concludes, well, it must be magic. That is the logical disconnect. You break the chain of causality so severely that reverse engineering becomes literally impossible.
That makes so much sense. And to achieve this level of cognitive overload, the manuscript details a heavy, heavy amount of pre-show preparation. It is definitely not just walking on stage and winging it.
Not at all.
Before the audience even arrives at the theater, Jermay is doing a ton of prep work. He takes an 8x10 sheet of paper and actually pre-writes the vast majority of the prediction letter.
He writes it before the show even starts.
Yes. He writes down the physical description of the female spectator he is going to select. He writes down a specific time. He writes a prediction about a color. He writes a male name and a physical description of that male.
Okay, wait. But the architecture of that letter is crucial.
Yeah.
He doesn't just write a solid block of text, does he?
No, not at all. He leaves very specific, strategically placed blank spaces in that letter. He leaves a blank for a location and a blank for a birthday.
So it's like Mad Libs.
Exactly like Mad Libs. Then he folds this letter up into eighths. He folds it in such a way that it completely hides all the pre-written text, but exposed right on the top layer are those specific blank spots.
That's so clever.
Then he clips this tightly folded packet underneath the cap of his marker and hides the whole thing under the cover page of his notepad.
You know what this feels like?
What?
It feels exactly like watching a chef on a high-end cooking show.
Oh, I love that comparison.
You see them toss a few raw ingredients into a pan, they chat with the host for a minute, and then they smile, reach under the counter, and pull out a perfectly baked souffle. All the hard work, all the vegetable chopping, the measuring, the resting of the dough, it was all done hours before the cameras even rolled.
That is a wonderful analogy. In magic, just as in cooking television, the illusion of spontaneity is almost always the result of meticulous, hidden preparation.
Germain is preloading the impossible.
Exactly. But this level of preparation does raise a massive logistical problem.
Right, because if I'm thinking about this logically, he's basically locked himself in.
Completely.
If he has already written down the exact time, the name of the male love interest, and the physical description of the woman he's going to bring on stage, I mean, doesn't he completely lose the ability to adapt?
That is the big question.
What if the audience doesn't pick those things? He is committing to a highly specific script before he even knows who his volunteer is going to be.
And that is exactly where the concept of forcing comes in.
Forcing?
Right. He doesn't need to adapt to the audience's choices because the audience isn't actually making any choices. He is engineering an environment where they only feel like they are making free decisions.
That's the illusion of choice.
Precisely. And to do this, he has to prepare the physical props just as meticulously as he prepared that prediction letter.
So let's talk about the romance novel, because this is where the physical engineering gets really clever. In the routine, the premise is that the performer and the spectator are going to collaboratively cast an imaginary pulp romance novel.
Right.
So he needs a prop. The text explicitly says to go to a used bookstore and buy the cheapest, weirdest, most cliche pulp romance novel you can find.
Which, first of all, adds instant comedic value to the presentation.
Absolutely. But the mechanical preparation of this book is brilliant. How does he turn a cheap paperback into a weapon?
Well, he adapts an incredibly old principle. Germain flips through this cheap novel until he finds a page with a single male name surrounded by female characters.
Okay.
And this name has to be followed immediately by a highly descriptive paragraph of what that man looks like. Let's say the name is Alejandro, and it describes his brooding eyes and a jagged scar.
Classic romance novel stuff.
Oh, totally. Once he finds that perfect page, he takes a pair of scissors. He trims that specific page slightly shorter than the rest of the book, but he cuts it on a diagonal angle.
A diagonal angle.
Yeah. The bottom edge is trimmed more than the top.
The manuscript compares this to a blow book. I've never heard of that. What actually is a blow book?
A blow book is a centuries-old mechanical magic prop. It was originally used by magicians hundreds of years ago to show a book full of blank pages, and then suddenly the pages would be full of illustrations.
Oh, like a flipbook illusion.
Sort of. It relies on pages being cut at different lengths or having alternating tabs. Depending on exactly where you place your thumb when you flip or riffle through the pages, the book will automatically fall open to the exact page you want it to.
That's wild.
Your thumb basically bypasses the shorter pages and catches on the longer ones.
It's physical hardware programming.
Exactly. By trimming this romance novel diagonally, Germain has created a natural breaking point.
So he controls where the book opens.
Yes. Whenever he holds the book out and riffles the pages for a spectator, if he places his thumb in the right spot, it will naturally catch on that slightly longer edge. It forces the book to open to that exact predetermined page with Alejandro on it.
That is just devious.
He then does the same thing on another page with a random object on it, trimming it on the opposite diagonal.
It's mechanical engineering disguised as just casual page flipping.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it and it just looks like a battered paperback.
Totally.
Okay, so the props are rigged. The prediction letter is mostly written, perfectly folded to expose the blank spots, and hiding under the notepad. The trap is completely set.
The snare is laid.
Right. But the trick hasn't actually started yet. The very first hurdle Germain faces is that he needs a volunteer. But not just any volunteer. He needs a woman who exactly matches the physical description he already wrote on the back of his hidden prediction letter an hour ago in his dressing room.
Which is a huge constraint.
It is. Which brings us to the very first deception on stage. The random volunteer and the stage whisper.
This opening sequence is an absolute masterclass in audacity. The audience believes they are witnessing a completely fair, statistically random selection process.
How does he frame it?
Well, the performer asks every single woman in the audience to think of a random number between 1 and 300. He justifies this by saying the romance novel has 300 pages, so they're going to pick a page number.
Which is so smart, because it establishes a logical reason for the numbering. It frames the choice within the context of the upcoming story, rather than just feeling like a math test.
Precisely. It gives the action a narrative purpose. Then, the performer pulls out a blank index card. He asks a few women in the audience what number they are thinking of, just to show how diverse the choices are.
To establish the randomness.
Right. Then, he dramatically reveals the number he supposedly wrote on his index card before the show started. He says, "I wrote a number between 20 and 30. Stand up if you guessed in that range.
Okay.
A few women stand. Then he says, "I wrote the number 27. Everyone sits down except for the one woman who thought of 27. She is invited onto the stage as the star of the show.
If you're sitting in the audience, that looks like an absolute miracle before the main trick has even begun. I mean, it looks like he predicted her exact thought out of a crowd of hundreds of people.
It looks completely impossible.
But the reality is almost shockingly brazen. He didn't predict anything. He used a tool called a thumb writer. I had heard of these, but reading about how they actually work is just wild.
A thumb writer, specifically the Boone style mentioned in the manuscript, is a tiny, usually flesh-colored gimmick that attaches directly to the pad of the performer's thumb.
Directly on the skin?
Yes. It holds a microscopic piece of pencil lead. It allows the performer to secretly write on a piece of paper that they are holding completely openly in front of the audience simply by making microscopic movements with their thumb joint.
But the physical difficulty of that. You are holding a card out, people are looking at you, and you have to write legibly with just the tip of your thumb, pressing against a card you are holding in the air, without moving your wrist or your arm.
It's incredibly difficult.
The tension in the hand must be immense.
It requires an unbelievable amount of practice. And the sheer audacity required to do it is what protects it. Because no normal person thinks, oh, he's writing with a tiny piece of graphite glued to his thumb.
Right. It's just not in our vocabulary of human behavior.
It's completely outside the realm of normal human experience.
So let's break down the choreography of how this deception actually plays out in real time. While Jermaine is asking the audience for their random numbers, he is actively scanning the crowd. He is hunting for a specific target.
Exactly.
He spots a woman who happens to perfectly match the description he pre-wrote on the letter. Let's say it's a brunette wearing a red sweater. He locks onto her, points directly at her, and asks for her number.
She says, for example, 27. At that exact microsecond, Jermaine looks down at the blank index card in his hand, and using the microscopic lead hidden on his thumb, he secretly writes a 2 and a 7 on the card.
And this is where we have to talk about the psychology of time misdirection. Because if he revealed the card the very second after she said her number, the audience would instantly connect the two events.
Oh, absolutely. They might not know how he wrote it, but their brains would suspect that he did. The proximity in time is too close.
So how does he solve that?
Well, you're hitting on a fundamental limitation of human working memory. Our working memory, basically the mental RAM we use to process immediate events, can only hold about 4 to 7 items at a time.
Right.
If Jermaine reveals the card immediately, that interaction is the only thing in their RAM. But he doesn't do that. This is where the artistry lies. After writing her number, he deliberately points to 3 or 4 other women in the audience and asks for their numbers. What about you? 142? Great. You? 88. Excellent.
Oh, he's flooding their RAM.
Exactly. Right. It is like a cognitive DDoS attack. He creates a temporal buffer. He fills the audience's working memory with completely useless data.
That is so manipulative, but so smart.
By the time he finally reveals the index card, the specific moment he interacted with the target woman has been buried under a pile of near irrelevant numbers. The audience simply remembers the aggregate experience. They remember he asked a bunch of people, and amazingly, the card matches one of them.
The chronological order of events is totally scrambled in their minds.
It completely erases the moment of the secret writing. It's brilliant.
So the time misdirection works. He now has the perfect spectator. She matches his pre-written description. He invites her up onto the stage, and the audience erupts into applause to welcome her.
Right.
And right here, under the cover of that roaring applause, Jermaine executes the second major steal of information. He uses something called the Dunninger ploy to get her secret birthday.
The Dunninger ploy is named after Joseph Dunninger, who was one of the most famous and successful mentalists of the 20th century.
Okay.
It is stripped of all its mystique and grandiosity, nothing more than a stage whisper. As the audience is clapping, the performer walks to the edge of the stage, extends his hand to help the woman up the stairs, leans in close, and simply asks her, "What is your birthday? Just the month and the day."
I have to say, I love this so much.
It's so bold.
It is so breathtakingly bold. If I can bring in an analogy from the tech world, this is exactly like a social engineering hack in cybersecurity.
Oh, how so?
Well, a bank can spend millions of dollars building the most sophisticated, mathematically unbreakable firewall in the world to protect their data. But a clever social engineer doesn't attack the firewall.
They just bypass it.
Right. They just put on a high visibility vest, carry a clipboard, walk through the front door of the office building, and confidently ask the receptionist for the password. And the receptionist just gives it to them. The Dunninger ploy is walking through the front door.
That is exactly what it is.
It bypasses all the mechanical trickery, all the thumb writers and rigged books, and simply asks her for the information.
It is the path of least resistance. But it relies entirely on a very specific manipulation of the social and physiological dynamics of the stage environment.
Okay, here's where I really need to push back.
Mm.
I am sitting here imagining this scenario.
Okay.
He asks her for her birthday. She tells him. 10 minutes later, he is going to open an envelope, read a letter, and miraculously predict your birthday. Are you seriously telling me she doesn't stand there on stage and think, buddy, I literally just told you that 5 minutes ago?
It seems crazy, right?
Why doesn't she immediately bust him in front of everyone? How can someone just forget they handed over the most crucial piece of data?
It seems impossible when you're sitting in a quiet room thinking about it logically, but you have to understand the severe physiological response of being pulled out of a dark crowd and thrust under stage lights.
It's intense.
When an average person is suddenly the center of attention in front of hundreds of staring strangers, their body triggers an acute stress response. They experience a massive spike of adrenaline and cortisol.
You're talking about severe stage fright.
Yes, but let's break down what stage fright actually does to the brain. It causes a localized form of tunnel vision, both visually and cognitively. You experience auditory exclusion.
Auditory exclusion.
Your brain literally filters out sounds that aren't immediately threatening. Your cognitive load maxes out simply trying to remember how to walk naturally, figuring out where to stand, wondering what to do with your hands, and hoping you don't trip over a microphone cable. You are in survival mode, not analytical mode.
So her brain isn't even recording properly.
Exactly. Furthermore, when Jermaine asks her for her birthday during the walk up the stairs, it happens in a liminal space.
A liminal space, like a transition.
It is happening in the transition. In her mind, the official trick hasn't started yet. Her brain doesn't flag that whispered interaction as important data to store. By the time the grand finale happens 10 minutes later, she has undergone a barrage of strange instructions.
Right, she's doing so much other stuff.
She's riffled books, she's spun mechanical watches, she's visualized characters. That tiny whispered question on the stairs is completely overwritten in her short-term memory.
And even if she does remember.
Even if a faint echo of it remains, the intense social pressure to not ruin the show, to play along with the charismatic authority figure, will almost always keep her silent.
It's mind control through sheer environmental pressure and biology.
Yeah.
Okay, you've convinced me. So we are through the first phase. The performer has successfully forced the right spectator onto the stage, and he has secretly pocketed her birthday in his own memory for later use.
The foundation is set.
Now, the collaborative storytelling begins. They are creating this imaginary romance novel. Jermaine asks her, where should this story take place? Paris, New York, Milwaukee.
This is a critical moment because this is the first piece of information the spectator gets to genuinely, freely choose for the story. Let's say she thinks about it and chooses Rome.
And what does Jermaine do? He takes out his notepad. And he openly, clearly writes the word Rome on the pad, showing it to the audience.
And we must emphasize this detail. He is actually writing Rome on the notepad. No secret thumb writing, no hidden billets. It is a completely fair, 100% transparent action.
Which, given everything we've talked about, feels completely counterintuitive. I mean, he has a hidden prediction paper under that pad. He needs to get Rome onto that paper. Why not use this perfect moment to double write it? Why play fair?
Because of that logical disconnect we discussed earlier, he is establishing a behavioral baseline.
A baseline?
Yes. He needs the audience to see exactly what his body language looks like when he legitimately writes something down. No weird grips, no stalling, no hidden movements. He builds absolute trust.
Oh, I see.
Because what comes next is the most brilliant mechanical deception of the entire routine, and it relies entirely on the trust he just built.
Right. So they have a location, Rome.
Yeah.
Next, they need a leading man for this pulp romance. Germain hands the romance novel to the spectator, but then he takes it back and riffles the pages toward her, asking her to say stop whenever she wants.
And this is where that physical preparation of the blow book comes into play. Because he trimmed that one specific page on a diagonal angle, his thumb naturally snaps off that exact page when she says stop.
It doesn't matter when she says stop.
It doesn't matter if she says stop after 3 seconds or 10 seconds. The physical engineering of the paper forces the book to open to the predetermined page.
Let's say the forced name on that page is Alejandro. She looks at the page, she reads the name Alejandro, and she announces it to the theater.
Now, Germain picks up his notepad to record this newly discovered character name. But here is the massive secret. The name Alejandro is already pre-written on the notepad.
No way.
Yes. He wrote it on the top sheet in his dressing room before the show even started, and he has been hiding it perfectly underneath his thumb this entire time.
Okay, wait. If the name is already written on the pad, what is he doing with his pen when he actively pretends to write it down in front of everyone?
He is executing the first double write.
Okay, lay this out for me.
Under the cover of the notepad, completely out of sight of the audience, that folded prediction billet is resting. While he is pantomiming the action of writing Alejandro on the visible pad, he is actually writing the word Rome, the location she freely chose a moment ago, into the exposed blank space of the hidden prediction letter.
Oh, wow. Let's really analyze the mechanics of this, because this completely solves Germain's original complaint about the classic confabulation routine.
It solves the lag problem.
Exactly. In the old versions, the performer asks for a piece of info. The spectator says it, and then the performer stands there awkwardly in dead silence, secretly writing it down on the hidden paper. The delay is glaringly obvious. The brain detects the stalling.
But Germain has fundamentally shifted the timeline of reality.
Right. By writing the previous piece of information while pretending to write the current piece of information, the delay is completely perfectly masked.
The physical action of writing matches the logical expectation of the audience. They just heard her say Alejandro. They see him put pen to paper. They hear the scratching of the ink. The visual and auditory cues confirm exactly what they expect to happen.
They are completely unaware that the data he is actually recording is lagging one step behind reality.
It's incredibly elegant.
You know, it's exactly like playing a multiplayer video game online when there's server lag.
Oh, how so?
Well, the game designers know there is a delay between you pressing the button and the server registering it.
Hmm.
So they hide the lag using client-side prediction. When you press the jump button, your character immediately plays a jumping animation on your screen, giving you instant visual feedback, even though the server hasn't caught up yet.
Oh, that's perfect.
The visual feedback hides the latency. Germain is hiding the latency of double writing by syncing it with the forced preloaded information.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. And the physical mechanics of how he handles the paper during this process are just as elegant as the psychological mechanics. The manuscript mentions that he uses a classic close-up coin magic move to manipulate the folded billet around the notepad.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. The text gets very specific, saying he grips the billet between the base of the fingers and the thumb crotch.
Right.
How exactly does moving a piece of folded paper around mimic a coin trick, and why is sleight of hand even necessary in a mentalism routine?
Well, if you imagine a standard old-school mentalism routine, the performer usually has to hold the clipboard or notepad very stiffly, clamped tightly against their chest or stomach.
So the audience doesn't accidentally see the hidden paper underneath.
Exactly. It looks rigid. It looks unnatural. Mm-hmm. Germain borrows a technique from close-up coin magic, specifically a variation of a finger palm, to dynamically move the hidden billet.
Okay, break that down for me.
When he wants to show the front of the notepad to the audience, he secretly slides the billet down into the crook of his thumb, the thumb crotch, holding it pressed against the back of his hand. This allows him to flash the notepad openly with his fingers spread wide.
So it looks completely empty.
It looks incredibly fair and casual. Then, when he turns the pad back toward himself to write, he slides the billet back up onto the face of the pad, under the cover of the motion, ready to be written on.
That is so fluid.
It is. It imports the grace and invisibility of sleight-of-hand magic into the normally rigid world of mentalism.
So the location is now secretly recorded on the prediction, and the name has been mechanically forced. But a juicy romance novel needs more than just a name. It needs a vivid, passionate description of the leading man.
Right.
And this is where Germain ensures the spectator's imagination perfectly matches his pre-written letter without him having to write down a single word on stage.
This brings us to a concept known as dual reality. It is one of the most powerful and, frankly, slightly unsettling psychological tools a performer can use.
The physical description selection relies entirely on this. Germain asks the spectator to describe the leading man, Alejandro. But remember, she is still physically holding the forced romance novel. Germain gives her very specific, carefully worded instructions.
What does he say?
He tells her, take a moment to look on the page for a name that jumps out at you. When you see a man's name, take a few moments to read the sentences and paragraphs near the name.
Right.
And later he says, do your best to picture him as if you were conjuring the image directly from the pages of the romance novel.
Conjuring the image directly from the pages. That is heavily loaded language. You have to analyze how that phrase is processed by two different groups of people.
Okay.
The audience hears that and thinks it's a metaphor. They think he is asking her to use her imagination to invent a character inspired by the vibe of the book. But the woman on stage, standing under the hot lights, full of adrenaline, hears something entirely different.
This is the core of dual reality. You are creating two entirely different subjective experiences simultaneously, using the exact same sequence of words.
Precisely. The spectator on stage is interpreting his instructions completely literally. She is simply reading the descriptive paragraph printed directly underneath the forced name on the page. She reads aloud that he has dark, brooding eyes and a jagged scar across his cheek.
She thinks she is just following instructions and reading the text.
The audience, however, believes she is freely, creatively inventing this appearance from her own mind.
It's doublespeak. We see this outside of magic all the time.
Oh, absolutely. Think about politics.
Right. A politician will answer a debate question using such carefully focused, grouped, coded language that it allows two completely different voter demographics to walk away thinking the candidate completely agrees with them. The words mean one thing to one group and something else to the other.
It is exactly the same mechanism. And the beauty of this from Germain's methodological standpoint is that he doesn't record this physical description on his notepad at all. He just listens to her read it and he nods along.
So that adds another layer to the logical disconnect.
Yes. The audience has seen him write things down previously, but now he isn't writing. It breaks the pattern they were starting to form. Yet when the final letter is read at the end of the show, that exact physical description will be in there because it was already part of the massive block of text he pre-wrote before the show.
Incredible. Okay, moving on to the next element of the story. Time. Every romantic rendezvous needs a time. Germain physically takes off his wristwatch and hands it to the spectator. He tells her to turn the face downward so she can't see the numbers and to spin the little dial on the side of the stem, moving the hands to a completely random time.
Now we're shifting from psychological forcing back to purely mechanical forcing.
Also,
the watch is gimmicked. The text explains it has a two-step stem. This was a common feature on older Swatch watches, and you still see it on some mid-range modern analog watches. Mm-hmm. If you pull the stem all the way out, turning it changes the time, like normal.
Yeah.
But if you push it halfway in until it clicks, the stem will spin freely, giving tactile feedback, but the internal gears are completely disengaged. The hands of the watch do not move a single millimeter.
I love this. This is exactly like giving a toddler one of those little plastic steering wheels attached to the front of a grocery cart.
Yes, that is perfect.
The kid is back there spinning the wheel furiously, making engine noises, completely convinced they are the one navigating the cereal aisle. But the wheel isn't connected to the axle. The parent is pushing the cart in a straight line, regardless of what the toddler does.
That is a flawless analogy. The spectator spins the dial on the watch. She feels the tactile resistance of the stem turning against her fingers. She believes she is wildly altering the time.
But Germain had already set the watch to exactly 8.15 p.m. before he ever walked on stage.
When she finally flips it over, she reads 8.15. It feels like an incredible coincidence to her, but it's just mechanical isolation.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate again, because I am trying to put myself in her shoes.
Okay, go for it.
I am holding the watch. I am spinning the dial. What if I just happen to look at the face while I'm spinning it, and I notice that the minute hand isn't moving at all? Doesn't the whole illusion shatter right there? Why doesn't she check the work?
It could shatter, in theory. But again, we must consider the environmental psychology of the stage and the concept of cognitive load. First, Germain explicitly, authoritatively instructs her to turn the face downward. Oh. People generally follow the firm instructions of an authority figure, especially when hundreds of people are watching them to see if they follow directions. Second, her cognitive load is entirely focused on the fine motor action of spinning the tiny dial and the social pressure of performing the task correctly.
She is not in an analytical, investigative state of mind.
Exactly. She is not a watchmaker trying to debug the prop. She is in an obedient, performative state. The physical design of the watch, combined with the psychological pressure of obedience, creates a massive blind spot.
So she flips the watch over and announces the time, 8:15. And once again, Jamea puts pen to notepad to record the selection.
And once again, he is executing the double right. Just like with the name Alejandro, the time 8:15 is already written on the visible top sheet of his notepad, hidden safely beneath his thumb.
So as he pretends to write the time for the audience, what is he actually writing onto the blank space of the hidden prediction billet?
The birthday. The birthday he whispered to her on the stairs when she first walked on stage.
Wow.
Exactly. He pulls that stored memory back up, and under the perfect logical cover of recording the time, he is writing October 12th onto the folded letter. The lag is beautifully hidden once again. The physical action completely, seamlessly justifies the delay.
It is a stunning sequence of choreography. So the physical forces are done, the mechanical forces are complete, the secret writing is finished. But Germain isn't done.
No, he's got one more layer.
For the grand finale of the selections, he layers in a completely different kind of deception. One that doesn't rely on gimmicked books or tricky watches or secret thumbs. This one relies entirely on how the human brain processes immediate choices.
Up until now, her choices have been mediated by props. A book, a watch. Now he removes the props entirely. He asks her a direct, naked question. He says, if I asked you to name a color without thinking, what would it be?
So we've seen how he controls physical objects and how he controls her memory of the birthday. But what happens when there is no prop? What happens when he just asks her a naked question? How does he control a thought that hasn't even happened yet?
He uses what the manuscript calls a purely psychological force. It notes that if you ask a person this exact question and demand an immediate split-second answer, statistically, the vast majority of people will panic and say, red.
Why red?
Culturally and biologically, red is our most primal color. It's the color of blood, of stop signs, of alarms. It is the first color the panicked brain reaches for.
Right.
But if they pause for even a second to think about it, their brain rejects the first obvious answer because they want to seem creative, and they will almost always say blue.
And if they try even harder.
The third most popular, if they really try to be unique and think outside the box, is purple.
It's an aggressive attack on the brain's default neural pathways. You aren't forcing a choice in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
You are predicting the statistical probability of human thought patterns under pressure. But a statistical probability isn't a 100% guarantee.
No, it isn't.
Which is my biggest question about this part. Does throwing a statistical psychological force into a highly mechanical guaranteed trick risk ruining the whole illusion?
That's the danger.
What if the woman happens to be an interior designer and she blurts out chartreuse or yellow? If the prediction letter says blue, the trick is ruined at the final hurdle.
This is where the concept of multiple outs is brilliantly woven into the prediction letter itself.
Multiple outs, okay.
Germain doesn't just predict one single color and hope for the best. The letter is written in a highly specific, almost poetic way to cover all the statistical bases. The pre-written text says, I will be wearing a blue scarf. The scarf often changes under the light. It appears as if it changes from red to blue, and finally to your favorite color, purple.
That is incredibly sneaky. So all three statistical likelihoods are baked right into the text. No matter which of the three she says, it's on the paper.
Yes, but the real magic is in the performance of the reveal. It's not enough to just read that sentence off the paper, because then it sounds like a multiple choice test where he just circled all the answers.
Right.
Germain frames it verbally to make it seem like he didn't just predict the final color, he predicted her entire internal train of thought.
The manuscript gives the exact wording. He looks at her and says, I think the first choice you had in mind was red. Then we moved over to blue. And the idea of purple did flash in front of your eyes, right?
Notice what he is doing there. He is retroactively defining her internal experience. He is actively telling her what she thought.
And because human memory is so malleable, so easily overwritten, especially under the stress of stage lights,
she will likely nod and agree, genuinely believing he mapped her exact cognitive process. Even if she only ever thought of blue, the confident suggestion that red and purple flashed in her mind makes the prediction feel intimately, deeply accurate.
It elevates the reveal from a simple word match to an act of deep, invasive mind reading. Stage presence and sheer confidence sell the illusion. So we arrive at the grand finale.
The payoff.
The selections are over. Jermay has all the information. He slides the hidden folded billet off the notepad, and under the cover of reaching for his wallet, he secretly loads it inside. Or into a balloon, as he mentions he sometimes prefers.
The isolation of the prediction is the final psychological lock on the vault door. The audience sees him pull a sealed envelope out of a zippered wallet or pull a piece of paper out of a popped balloon. It feels utterly, physically impossible that he could have touched the paper inside recently. It seals the logical disconnect.
He hands the envelope to the spectator. She tears it open, and Jermay reads the letter aloud. Let's synthesize this whole routine because the compounding effect is staggering.
It really is.
As he reads, what the audience hears is a single, cohesive letter predicting a beautifully random sequence of events. He accurately describes the woman's physical appearance. He predicts Rome. He predicts Alejandro and his jagged scar. He predicts 8:15 p.m. He predicts the blue scarf. And finally, the ultimate gut punch, he predicts her secret birthday as the day of the romantic rendezvous.
If we step back and look at the architecture of what we just analyzed, why is this specific sequence so devastating to an audience's critical thinking?
Because there's no single thread to pull.
Exactly. It's because Jermay attacks the brain from six entirely different angles. He uses a hidden thumb writer for the number, a stage whisper for the birthday, a mechanically altered book for the name, doublespeak and dual reality for the physical description, a gimmicked mechanical watch for the time, and statistical evolutionary psychology for the color.
You can't reverse engineer it because there is no single engine to reverse. The mind is completely overwhelmed by the sheer variety of the deceptions.
The logical disconnect is absolute. The brain, unable to find a unified theory for the deception, has no choice but to surrender to the narrative of impossibility. It is a masterpiece of cognitive overload.
We have really taken a journey today. We started with a classic, somewhat clunky magic trick and watched a master mentalist tear it down to the studs.
Rebuilt from the ground up.
We explored how every single choice an audience member makes can be meticulously engineered, controlled, and forced, all while preserving the perfect, pristine illusion of free will. We saw how working memory can be flooded, how mechanical props can isolate choices, and how the lag of secret writing can be hidden in plain sight.
It is a profound reminder of how vulnerable our perception of reality truly is. When the environment around us is controlled, our choices are rarely our own.
Which leaves us with a fascinating and maybe slightly unsettling final thought for everyone listening.
Oh, what's that?
We've just spent this deep dive seeing how easily a group of intelligent people can be convinced that predetermined choices were made freely, using logical disconnects, time misdirection, and environmental pressure.
Uh-huh.
But this isn't just about stage magic. Where else in your daily life are your free choices actually carefully engineered forces?
That is a great question. Think about the layout of your local supermarket.
Oh, yeah.
The dairy is always in the far back corner, forcing you to walk past thousands of highly profitable, visually stimulating items just to get a gallon of milk.
It's totally engineered.
Think about the UX design of the apps on your phone, where the accept button to share your data is bright blue and massive, and the decline button is hidden in tiny gray text at the bottom.
Right.
Think about the framing of political arguments, where the parameters of the debate are set long before you are ever asked for your opinion.
The psychological forces are everywhere. The choices are pre-written, the props are gimmicked, and we are just reading our lines, completely convinced we wrote the script.
We're all just participants in the routine.
It brings us right back to the beginning. The vault door isn't blown off its hinges. The alarms aren't blaring. You just walked in, smiled at the guard, and handed over the gold. We'll see you next time.